Welcome. This is Current Yield, Grant's Interest Rate Observer of the Air. And the fellow with the head cold, modulated voice is me. That's Jim Grant. I'm with you, as always, with the great deputy editor of Grant's, Evan Lorenz. Evan, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Yeah. And Henry French, who does our engineering so well. Henry, howdy. And we have a guest today, and his name is Steve Bogdan. And Steve knows a few things about investment strategy and geopolitical strategy and how the two connect. And he can talk to us about some of the extraordinary facts that have come to light concerning, for example, I would call the naval competition between China and America, except that one side of that competition seems not to know there's a competition. So we'll get around to that presently. Evan, we take a rather platonic view of advertising on this program. We don't like to sit out our own whistle. It's unseemly, and we're all also just rich enough anyway. Who can, right?
Yeah, we occasionally throw a great conference, and occasionally the future, you know, Treasury Secretary might come and speak at them.
Right. And we also, as a sideline to the ones, to the comments, we publish every 2 weeks, right? Let's not forget that. And we did so last night. So what reminds me of the present state of play in almost everything is a Grant's piece from 2 weeks ago. And the headline is View from the Crazy Train. Evan, you suggested that, and it's a compilation of valuations and transactions and declarations, and every one is more implausible than the next, right? It's just 12 or 15 of things you couldn't believe have happened, but oh yeah, they happened. They are happening. So can you regale our listening audience, Evan, with one or two of your favorites, this idea that you generated so
sure,
timely?
I think one of my favorites is, you remember Peanut the Squirrel, the squirrel who New York authorities euthanized because for no real good reason.
He's a libertarian martyr of a squirrel, right?
Libertarian martyr of a squirrel. Well, somebody created a cryptocurrency named Peanut the Squirrel Coin, and it had a market cap of around $1.7 billion, which is bigger than a number of gold miners that we could name. People are really excited about private companies that are fast growing and on the right tech trend. There's a ETF called Destiny Tech 100. It invests in these. It's trading at a 800% premium to its net asset value. So not only are you buying these companies, which are often trading at very high multiples, you're buying them at an 800% premium to those lofty multiples.
But there's a catch here, right? I mean, there's an explanation, isn't there?
Number go up. And I think one that really captures the zeitgeist is Trump Media and Technology Group, which is the president-elect social media network, is actually in talks to acquire a cryptocurrency trading firm, Bakkt Holdings, from International Exchange.
Okay, so I would say, Evan, that even the best of your selection, this were superseded the other day by a now rather familiar piece of speculative conduct, and that is the purchase, I think it's Sotheby's auction, of a piece of art that captioned comedian. And it was created some time ago, but with the materials, the affect of the piece, I think could be rather simply described as it's a banana duct taped to a piece of wood, right? Sort of thing.
If you want to describe it so crassly, yes.
Yeah. Okay, so everyone knows that it was sold, and knows, can't help but know that it sold at a very pretty price of $6 million plus, I think $6.2 million, just last month. And Evan, do you remember that after the sale, the winner, a crypto mogul called Justin Sun, untaped his accession, peeled it clean, and popped it right into his mouth? Now, you're not smiling, Steve. You have to get into this. And recall, gentlemen, that there was a great book in the history of finance called Where Are the Customers' Yachts? Okay, Fred Schwed Jr. came out in 1940. Anyway, it was a properly cynical take on Wall Street by somebody who had been around for 1929, then the 1937. Nothing had gone right on Wall Street for a long time. And Schwed said, now let's see, what I've read all these economists and their views about what caused the crash of 1929, but I think I've come up with a real cause. And the real cause he identified as the gesture that the New York Central Railroad, still in private hands, made to its riding public. And the gesture was an accommodation. And before the crash, it seemed as if a nickel wasn't very much money. It bought you a subway ride. But rather than watch its valued clientele have to reach into their pockets or pocketbooks, fish around for a nickel to get on the subway to go downtown. New York Central Railroad put out a wooden bowl full of nickels, free money. And Fred Schwed's view was improvident, that God testing, symbolic act of defiance towards the proper attitude towards, against financial propriety, we'll call it. You don't throw away money. You treat it as if it is the thing it is, which is money is work. No, money is work. And Fred Schwed said, half tongue in cheek, that's what caused the crash. So, gentlemen, I ask you to fast forward, just a few decades and then half century, and compare and contrast a bowl of nickels with eating a banana that cost the guy $6.2 million. Which is a greater provocation to the market gods? I don't know. I kind of feel like I'm going to give up, Evan.
Do you know if the banana was good?
Looked great.
Always money in the banana stand.
Yeah, right. And the press went around and interviewed the banana vendor who was pleased to allow that he had had no part of the $6.2 million. Indeed, he had sold for 35 cents. Yeah, whatever. Okay, so Steve Bogdan, welcome. You are an alumnus of Colby College, no?
I am.
And you attended that for the weather. You know, it's in Maine.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. And you went on to a very interesting political career. You're now an analyst of financial matters in a family office, no? And before that, you had considerable experience in the world of high-level political advisory work, and that includes the time with the the Republican governor John Huntsman of Utah, and some of the other offices I think that John Huntsman occupied for a succession of Republicans, beginning with Ronald Reagan. Yeah, and then along comes in your career with John McCain, advising the late Senator Commander John McCain.
Yes, who would remind us that it's always darkest right before it goes pitch black.
Right. And so that will let the audience understand the authority with which you speak. And not the only reason you're here, Steve, but it didn't hurt, is that you read Grand Central Trade Observer. In fact, subscribe to it. And we got together when you reminded us of a piece you wrote for the Wall Street Journal. This was in 2023, and the headline was "Capital's Making a Comeback." And it was a kind of a thought leaderish thing to have written, because at the time the idea was still current that there was such a thing as capitalism without capital. Now, that was the title of a book around that time, and you contended that that capital intensive, the world as you put it of atoms, the world capital intensive investment, including that for decarbonization of the electrical system in this country, the growing vulnerability of overseas supply chains, and the semiconductor industry's vulnerability to you-know-who. And I'm not sure you emphasize so much the looming possibility of outright war and what might that do to the demand for tangible investment, but certainly that was implicit in much of what you wrote. And we have discussed that, you and I have discussed it since then. So to begin with, what do you think now about the demand for tangible capital in the context of a bond market that seems not to want to go down in price as the Fed intends, rather seems almost intent on the obvious, that is pushing yields a little bit higher, at least not giving in to the Fed's rate cuts, the yield curve is steep. So is this an expression, perhaps, of the changed nature of this economy going from intangible things like software to very tangible things, such as steel?
In many ways, we're going back to the future. So between 1985 and 2021, the tangible investment share of the economy, netting out residential real estate, when it was initially 12.5%, it declined to 8.5%. That was offset by an increase in intangible investments, so software, for example, from 11.5% to 16.75%. So net a 1% increase during that time. I believe that's going into the reverse for a lot of the reasons that you described. The electrical demand as an example.
I didn't make that. See, you use what is it?
Electrical demand.
Yes. Okay.
So we know the AI story. Data centers are gangbusters right now. It's extraordinarily capital intensive. Just the copper that goes into the transmission lines that's going to be required for electrification. We have a massive shortfall because of underinvestment in commodities coming out of the financial crisis. So this is all new greenfield investment. It's going to be have a very long lag.
Yeah.
And that story plays out, you know, in, we're talking about remilitarization today. But same thing, we had a peace dividend coming out of the Cold War. So defense spending went from about 6% during the last period of great power competition to 3%, spiking to 4% during the surge in Iraq. And that's going to change. You're already seeing it in Europe. Real defense spending by NATO, European NATO defense members, NATO members in Europe is up by 1/3 since the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Bloomberg estimates to get back to Cold War levels of spending. That's about $10 trillion over the next decade in the West.
Where is the savings for that?
I believe it's going to put upward pressure on rates. So I'll make the case to you that even though we're running a 6.4% deficit relative to GDP right now during a peacetime expansion, which is beyond reckless, that next year the Congress is going to increase defense spending because we're kind of going to general quarters into D.C. So any savings they do get, and there's plenty of savings they can, you know, Medicaid.
They're not touching that.
Well, they've made some. There's some things they can do that just a Committee for Responsible Federal Budget estimated that just undoing some Biden executive orders can save $1.4 trillion over the next 10 years. But that's not very much money. It's $100 billion a year. And the spending's on a much higher magnitude.
My goodness, what big shots we are. $100 billion a year. I would say that's a lot of money, even when you say it fast.
But to put it into context, I mean, we're spending $980 billion in interest expense in the last fiscal year. We're expected to spend $1.1 trillion in the next fiscal year. And the average interest rate on federal debt right now is 3.3%. And the lowest rate on the yield curve is now 4.1%. So that kind of implies, if you're expecting rates to keep increasing, kind of a big increase on the interest part of the budget, which is really hard to cut without cutting debt, which we're not doing if we still have deficits.
Didn't Elon Musk list interest expense as a cost that he would like to cut? I think that came out of the Doge committee at first. Maybe somebody told him that. No, don't do that. Don't say that. There's a word for that. It also begins with D, just like Doge. Don't say it, though.
I agree with you. And keep in mind, we're still in a cutting cycle right now. So fixed income investors who want to lock in higher yield debts are still coming into treasury markets. But once the cutting cycle stops, and I think terminal rate's going to be close to 4. It's a lot sooner than people are currently think, I believe. I think you can see some real stress on long bond auctions. You know, tails are already increasing.
Yeah, we had a very bad 20-year auction. A week, 10 days ago. And 20-year auction is the one that failed in 1973. That was the only auction that failed in living memory. And have we talked about this? I hate to bore our listeners.
We've talked about it at Grants, but not on the podcast.
Yeah. And what happened, I guess August 1st, maybe. Anyway, it was in the summertime 1973. And they wanted the auction just fell flat in its face. Nothing can bids nowhere close to reaching the amount on offer. And a great big kerfuffle over this. The next day, however, the auction was a raging success. Bonds went out, flew out the window. And the Fed did not admit to it, but some people thought that the Fed itself came in and really helped things with encouraging the primary dealers to buy and generally stage managing this auction. Now, that was then, of course, that was 73 was a year with some inflation too. But if inflation is a problem and the Fed is seen as moving towards ease to facilitate a treasury auction, think about what seeds of concern that would plant in the minds of especially foreign investors. You know, when you borrow the money with which to pay interest, that is called Ponzi finance, and it's not generally the sign of a financially well managed country. So anyway, evidence can be a good copy.
Yeah. You will have interest rates to observe.
Yes, we went through a decade in the wilderness. Anyway, we are veering away a little bit from the order of the agenda. So we have discussed some of the strategic issues. Let me ask you, Stephen, how the Chinese naval buildup in particular is playing in Washington as you understand those dynamics, and are things quite as startlingly bad as we have been reading? You've sent us some things from the most respectable source. I have in front of me, something from the American Enterprise Institute that talks about the astounding disparity between Chinese shipyard capacity. This is by Brady Afric and Mackenzie Eaglet. You know them?
Mackenzie's at American AEI. She's great.
Yeah, okay. Quote, this is from a piece dated October 7th of this year, and the headline is, China is rapidly building warships. Satellite images reveal a scale. And whatever the opposite of a sensational headline is, that is it. It's most understated headline. So here is the dope. The data shows a stark divide. China's shipbuilding workforce is estimated to be nearly five times that of the United States and supports more than 7,000 vessels. Fewer than 200 are serviced by American shipyards, which fulfilled fewer than five orders in 2023, while their Chinese counterparts handled more than 1,700. So it's this step function disparity between, here's another one. China has been investing so much in shipbuilding over the past 18 years that it can now build more ships in a month than the United States can in a year. So how does this figure into things? How does this figure into grand strategic thinking? And how does it figure into the prospects for tangible investment?
So here's an illustration. The USS Connecticut, which is one of our four Seawolf-class submarines, hit a sea mound in the South China Sea in October of 2021. It won't be back into service until 2026. So we have enormous capacity constraints at our shipyards.
How many submarines are in the fleet?
40% are out of service right now.
Yeah. And they're out of service because of deferred maintenance?
Deferred maintenance.
And so in the private sector, one would call this deficit in CapEx. And this is kind of the kind of thing we expect of private equity, right? Paying out dividends to please the shareholders. They can buy things. And meanwhile, the plant and equipment and other tangible items on the corporate balance sheet might be going to rack and ruin.
So I think the best way to think about it is during the Cold War, the U.S. defense industrial base and the U.S. military was optimizing for resilience. It was optimizing to fight a great power war. After the end of the Cold War and the peace dividend we started cashing in 1993 when we cut the defense budget in half, we started optimizing for efficiency. And like a lot of the private sector, that led to hysteresis. We lost capacity.
What's that word?
Hysteresis, just atrophying.
Ah.
Yeah, you don't build things, you lose skilled workers.
It means fat and happy. I want to ask you, take the other side of this for a second. We watch goings-on in the Red Sea, and we watch the United States be exposed as by far not the lowest-cost producer of this battle of missiles and drones. And altogether, the cost of production, shall we call it, and military hardware seems in some departments of munitions seems to be collapsing. Evan is an Air Force brat and has followed some of this stuff. What is your least favorite aircraft?
Oh, the F-35. It's a program that's going to cost multiple trillions of dollars. And until earlier this year, I don't think the F-35 was actually clear to fly in inclement weather because rain and lightning damages the plane too much. So if we were going to be invaded, we had better hope it was on a sunny day.
Yeah, like that.
Well, so, you mentioned the Houthis. So there's one thing to illustrate the state of the U.S. military. When Biden, hit back at them finally last year, he used 80 Tomahawk missiles in one day.
80?
80. We bought 55 last year.
Oh.
So we're running down stocks.
How big is the inventory? I guess it's top secret, no?
You can estimate it, but it's classified.
Estimate?
1,500, perhaps.
That's kind of a dent, isn't it?
Can I ask you the devil's advocate question? So Russia had one of the great armies in the world. It had one of the largest tank forces in the world. And when it invaded Ukraine, it got eviscerated by, cast off military goods from the U.S. from like the 1980s and 1990s. To what extent is China a real threat, or to what extent is it a paper tiger? And in real threat, it has way more yards to build way more stuff than we do. So if anything gets destroyed, China can replace it. But in perhaps the paper tiger side, they recently built a submarine in Wuhan, which by satellite imagery instantly sunk back into the water.
I think someone left a door open.
But it wasn't a screen door, was it?
They did raise it. And, undersea, I'm not a naval officer, but these are very difficult things to build and operate. And they are going to have setbacks. But I do believe that, she's probably has some concerns about the capacity of the military.
Let me follow up on what I tried to was driving at not very effectively before, and that is, are we quite sure that given the huge cost of some altogether unsatisfactory cutting-edge weapons programs, are we sure that we need those in a day and age in which drones seemingly, maybe this is a civilian's misconception, drones seem to be out-competing pilot-flown fighters? Is that a thing, or is fighters, we still need fighters at these horrendous costs? And is it just possible that that we, the people, are imagining that they're fighting the last war by worrying about all the things we aren't building, when what might win the next war are things that are yet unbuilt but are now under the conception of our geniuses in Silicon Valley? In other words, is tech going to come to the rescue of a fat and happy America?
Potentially, eventually. Best way to think about drones is Ukraine today is what the Spanish-American War, the Spanish Civil War was to the Second World War. So the use of drones there will foreshadow what happens in the Western Pacific. But you're still talking about in Ukraine largely commercial drones being used. In the Western Pacific, you're talking about much longer distances. You're talking about having to deliver much heavier ordnance onto targets. That's not really available right now via drone. So yes, the U.S. Navy has this Hellscape initiative, which the Replicator project, which is a big DoD project to purchase thousands of drones in a crash program over the next 18 months. You see this, the tech sector is moving heavily into defense tech, and they're all chasing this Replicator money right now. I don't know how soon those capacities are going to be in the field for, warfighters in a serious way.
So yeah, if I understand it correctly now, your view is that drones might be a help someday, but they're not yet, especially for a war in China where we have to get so much munitions and explosive force over such a great distance, which is hard to do with things that fly maybe 100 miles. So right now the U.S. Navy is at a point where shipyards can't even keep the current ships running, much less build new ones. What needs to be done to fix it?
So I believe in the short term, we're going to have to outsource our industrial base. So you've seen the Japanese and the Korean shipbuilders since the invasion of Ukraine. Mitsubishi Heavy is up 615%. Kawasaki Heavy is up 190%. By contrast, General Dynamics is up 38%. So the Koreans are chasing Navy contracts right now. They just purchased the Philadelphia shipyard. There's a joint working group with Tokyo to allow Japanese shipyards perform more maintenance on American boats. So we're getting there. Longer term, we're not going to be able to beat the Chinese on industrial, in industrial capacity in any meaningful timeline. So we have to change the game. The Ukrainians have had enormous success with drones in the Black Sea. So maybe screwless systems like that, we're going to have to deploy, quickly.
Yeah, I recently read that Navy was having trouble finding sailors to the extent that it has to lay up a certain number of ships for lack of manpower to, get them underway. So what do we do about that?
I think in a hot labor market, the military always has recruiting difficulties.
A depression is going to be.
That would be helpful. But, it's worth keeping in mind, already half the U.S. defense budget is on personnel cost.
Yeah.
So to the extent that, just the Chinese have a huge advantage. Just they're spending more money than we are, and they have their purchasing power is very, very different. The staffing issues are huge. They're more pronounced at the shipyards, where we don't have enough welders to actually, run these things 24 hours a day if we needed to.
Don't have enough manpower.
And that's really skilled labor. Those guys you can't just hire those guys. You have to, they're apprenticeships. It takes years to train them.
Yeah.
So there have been some good pieces written by people like the AEI and the Wall Street Journal kind of bringing these problems up. You've written some articles on this. When you talk to people in D.C., do they recognize that there is a problem? And if so, what are they doing about it?
They absolutely do. Jim, you're a Navy alum. Like, General Quarters has been sounded in Washington, D.C. So Roger Wicker, the incoming chairman of the Armed Services Committee, has a proposal to bring defense spending up to 5% of GDP. Mitch McConnell is now chairman of the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee. He's made it clear that his swan song in the Senate's going to be trying to get the Pentagon money to solve these problems. The Pentagon is well aware. The current Admiral Pompeo, who's at PACCOM now, I suspect he believes he'll be a wartime commander and is, you know, they're on a wartime footing.
What is it about the system of accountability or the lack thereof that with, what is 40% of the subfleet laid up for lack of parts or to know-how? How is it that not one flag officer has resigned in protest to publicize what seems to be a clear and present danger to American security? I mean, was anybody fired over this? Don't you think that in the private sector, if CapEx had been shown to be neglected in this way, that the heads would roll and the stock price of the inattentive company would reflect it as well? I would drive by the Pentagon on the way to the airport. I look at these gray buildings and I think, yeah, they're asleep. No,
absolutely agree. And it's also shocking, for instance, the Fat Leonard scandal in the Navy, which has been rolling for 15 years. No senior flag officers have gone to jail over that. And these guys.
This was the commissary, the very helpful commissary guy in the West Pac.
Correct.
Yeah. Who had inveigled himself into the good graces of the senior officers and by doing a certain amount of favors, and he got special prices on things, and I gather did a more than good job at supplying things that he was supposed to have supplied, right? But then there was some extra on top of that.
I think all the officers involved had an excellent time.
Yeah. Okay. So. You wear these two hats on one single head. You are a keen student of the strategic situation on land, in the air, and at sea, and you're also in the buy low, sell high trades. So how do you combine those two, and what does, if I may ask, what does a strategically alert portfolio look like in this day and age? How do you express these views? There must be opportunities.
Oh, I absolutely agree. So just in the defense sector, which we were just talking about, I really like, you know, we're going to be buying a lot more munitions. The primes right now, so Raytheon, Lockheed, there's a lot more spending is coming.
The primes meaning prime.
Defense contractors. Yeah. So the leading defense contractors.
Yes.
So a lot of the weapon systems we need, and we need them fast, are built by those guys.
Now, how are they valued, and how are they trading, and is the trade pretty much traded in? I mean, this information is startling in its details, but certainly it's not unfamiliar in its outline. Is the play still on, or with a value investor's perspective, is it kind of played out?
I think the future, you can see it in Asia, right? So we have the... Right here, this is off of the Bloomberg. Hyundai Heavy in Korea is up 108%.
Yeah, right.
Huawei Aero is up 581% this year. That's since the invasion of Ukraine.
Now, of course, it could be up from very low levels. Do you happen to know offhand how they're valued? Is it?
I don't have the PEs of those right here, but I have the American PEs. You know, Lockheed's at 819. So they're attractive.
Yeah.
And the Japanese raised defense spending last year. It flowed directly through to their contractors. Yeah. So my bet is defense spending is going to flow through to these guys.
I wonder if the play on these strategic opportunities and the latent crises might be more in the macro side, particularly with regard to the yield shape of the yield curve. By the sound of things, some of these defense stocks, especially the ones in Japan, seem to have had a great run. And I'm wondering, as an alternative to chasing them, if there's not a play on the American yield curve. And I say that because, for one, the obvious play would be of rising rates in the context of the inflation that might be part and parcel of the return of a heavy dose of tangible capital investment, right? But one of the reasons that the inflation of the 1960s got up such a head of steam before people said, wow, there's an inflation problem, is that until that time, there's been no serious inflation in America except in times of war. That was because, because until that time, there had been a pretty rigorous metallic monetary standard. Some phases of it, some eras more disciplined than others, but basically the the dollar was defined as a unit of weight of silver or weight of gold. Okay, so that ended in 1971 through 1973, but until that time, people kind of brushed off inflation. So for example, 1945 to 47, there was a very bad inflation, but people brushed it off, I think, in part because the dollar was anchored and because experience had showed that there was no such thing, basically, as a peacetime inflation in an America of a convertible currency. So two things are really off the table for polite discussion. One is the likelihood of war. It's a shocking thing to talk about. The prospects for loss on all sides, human especially, but financial. Think of all the school books you could buy, the cost of all the imagined and certain, indeed, losses in lives and materiel. Okay, so that's one thing we don't talk about. The second thing we don't talk about, really, except in certain pages of certain financial journals, is the nature of a currency, namely the paper dollar, and its predilection for overissuance, for being overissued, and therefore for supporting and indeed instigating inflation impulses, so we call them. Okay, so here we are with a yield curve that seems to want to steepen, a world that seems to be most unhappy, caught in nations at each other's throats, and all this might seem to introduce a new element, not a new, but an unrecognized and a very largely undiscussed element of risk into the bond market.
I absolutely agree. So in the immediate aftermath of Trump winning and there being uniform control of government, so the Republicans controlled both the House and the Senate, the 10-year rose to 4.5. Now, it's fallen back to I believe, as markets anticipated, spending like we saw in 2017-18, only, you know, at a much higher interest rate. It's since fallen back to 4.3 as the market's expecting some degree of fiscal consolidation. I believe that's what it's thinking. I don't think it's going to get it because, you know, you raise the prospect of how expensive war is. Well, war is very expensive. Deterrence is cheaper than war. So if we want to prevent war, we need to spend now to make Xi's calculations in 2028 on a risk-adjusted basis less favorable.
Well, we could get an argument about that from David Stockman, the former Reagan director of the Office of Management and Budget, who knows more about the budget than even Elon Musk at this point. David's very keen on the fact that there ain't no such thing as a preparation, Pacific preparation for war, be that as it may, we are talking about the world as it is and perhaps not as it certainly ought to be, right? So I want to ask you something we haven't yet discussed, which is your experience with John McCain, certainly a great American. And I want to ask more particularly about his view of Alan Greenspan and what he was thinking about when he made this Weekend at Bernie's comment about Alan Greenspan and how he would have handled the Great Recession had he been elected. Would he have been an interventionist? I suppose so. Or maybe he would have listened to the better angels on his shoulder about beware of moral hazard and beware of unintended consequences of well-intended actions. Tell me about John McCain.
Well, I think Phil Graham, who was one of his close friends, was an advisor to the campaign on economics. I was on the campaign.
Yeah.
And he had to resign from the campaign in the summer. So this was in the lead up to the Lehman collapse, yeah, because he said the fundamentals of the economy were strong. And by that, he meant there were issues in, there was obviously something going on in the banking sector at the time. You know, we didn't know the run had started, like the bear hedge funds had failed in August 2007,
yeah,
and then there was kind of this quiet period. You guys obviously were very busy at the time.
Yes.
So John's view, he would not have let the banking system liquidate itself. He did understand the politics of that, and there would have been, TARP would have been structured, TARP was obviously, he wouldn't have been, that was passed prior to him winning, but it would have been structured in a different way.
What was he like? What was he like as a man? What was he like to work for?
I love John McCain. He was a 19th century man. And by that, I mean he cared, you know, more for his his personal honor than anything else. Great story about him. I was on a small plane with him and probably about 10 other people. And there was a small table. He was reading the newspaper. It's late at night. And it hit some turbulence. And, you know, people notice. I was drinking a beer. And then it hits some more turbulence, and some of the women let out a little sound. And McCain, you know, looks at them and says, "Guys, I've been in 4 plane crashes. This is not how I am going out." We keep going along, and then the train hit, we really hit turbulence, and, you know, drinks go flying out of people's hands, and, you know, people scream. And McCain puts his paper down and looks at everybody and goes, "On the other hand, the paper tomorrow could read, 'Plane crashes, John McCain, lone survivor.'"
Or McCain's not the pilot.
That's, yeah, he was not flying that one.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, Steve, is there anything else you would like to get off your chest as you have the opportunity?
I believe we're going to see a 5 handle for the 10 year next year.
You happen to know the month?
I believe the key drivers of investment are attracting a lot of dollars right now. The AI that is being driven by companies who believe have $1 trillion franchises, who think they are at risk. They're not going to stop spending. They're not price sensitive. The electrification story is very, very real. Europe, who are, you know, very reticent to spend on defense, are already up by 1/3. Trump's coming in. That's going higher. You're seeing remilitarization in the, you know, domestically in the U.S. And the labor force is, you know, increasingly constrained. Before the pandemic, when I would walk to the subway down Canal Street, you'd see cashiers at McDonald's. In New York City now, there's no cashiers at McDonald's. We're automating all of that stuff. And, the U.S., like, you know, in terms of just robots, we're way behind our comps globally. There was just in terms of industrial robots, we have only 63% as many of China, and they have much lower labor costs, and only 69% as many as Germany. Japan, we're just way behind. So all that investment is going to be happening. It's going to drive up the demand for capital on top of running a 6.4% government deficit during peacetime.
Betting on higher rates puts you in good company. Stanley Druckenmiller at our conference said that he is also bearish on treasuries. Are you expressing that through interest rate futures or just puts on the market?
I don't own treasuries. I'm out of treasuries right now. I don't have a trade on that.
Mm-hmm. Steve is expressing that by talking to us, for which we are very grateful. Steve, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
It's been very terrific indeed. And Henry, thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, especially thank you. You will listen to us in the next edition of Current Yield Grant's Interest Rate Observer at the Edge.